This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Tony Cox in Washington. Next year, women will be able to get birth control without copays or deductibles. The Obama administration on Monday accepted the recommendations of the Institute of Medicine that birth control and several other procedures, like HIV screening, be treated as preventive medicine. The administration says it's trying to eliminate the cost barrier to birth control that some women face today. It is a shift in policy, and for some, a confusing one at that. We have been hearing for days now about free birth control. We want to answer some of your questions about the changes that may affect you. Will this change affect whether or how you get birth control? What do you think the impact will be? Our number, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. In a few moments, we'll hear from Dr. Linda Rosenstock, who chaired the committee that recommended the change. And we'll also talk to law professor Helen Alvarez about religious exemptions from the ruling. First, though, we are joined now by NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Julie, thanks for dropping by.
My pleasure.
To be clear, let's start with this. This isn't exactly the free birth control that some headlines have been advertising.
No, it's not. First of all, it's only for people who have health insurance. It just means that you'll be paying for it as part of your premium rather than as you go. And so there will be no deductibles, no copays. It will make it easier to get. And hopefully, according to this Institute of Medicine panel that recommended it, it will, as you mentioned, take away some of the cost barriers at the time of usage to encourage more people to use it. It's one of these many preventive care services that the last year's health law is trying to encourage people to use. The law actually stipulated right within the law several types of preventive care services that it wanted to encourage people to get more of. So it wrote those into the law. Now, there was an amendment by Senator Barbara Mikulski of Maryland, suggesting that there were some women's health services that had not been added to the list, perhaps as they should have been. So it encouraged the Department of Health and Human Services to add those. The Department of Health and Human Services, in turn, asked the Institute of Medicine to look at which women's health services had enough of an evidence base to be added to this list. And there was this list of eight services, of which contraception was one.
And obviously, that is the lightning rod issue among those eight. But what are some of the other ones?
Some of the other ones are more support for breastfeeding, including rental of breast pumps. As you mentioned, screening for sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV, an annual well woman visit. That's something that right now a lot of women have to pay a copay for, and so therefore a lot of women don't get. And that's the key to a lot of these other services. If you can't go for an annual visit, perhaps you don't get that free pap smear or that free mammogram. So if you can't go for that annual visit, if you don't have the money to pay for that annual visit, you might not get some of these other quote-unquote free services.
Now, these services that we are talking about, they only affect women who already have health insurance. Is that correct?
That's right. And not even, perhaps, all of those. These only apply, and this is one of the confusing things about the health law, these only apply to new plans and plans that are not quote-unquote grandfathered. So if you had a plan that was in effect on the date the law was signed, which was March 23rd of 2010, it might not affect your plan until that plan changes. So as plans add or drop benefits or change their premiums dramatically, then until that happens, they're considered grandfathered. So the people who are your employer or your insurer, depending on who you're getting the plan from, don't have to add these benefits until they are no longer grandfathered. So they think that this will affect about 90 million people when it goes into effect next year. And obviously in 2014, when the new plans are available on these new health insurance exchanges, it will affect all of those plans. Eventually, these requirements will probably affect everybody, but not right away.
I know that health reform has been enacted, but I wonder whether this conversation might be premature in terms of whether or not health care reform is going to last. Is it going to survive the expected challenges to it?
Well, we're still waiting. There have been three court cases that are now at the Court of Appeals level. One of them was found in favor of the constitutionality of the law. We're waiting to hear from two more appeals courts. Obviously, we expect the Supreme Court to have the final say. But, you know, even if the Supreme Court were to find unconstitutional that so-called individual mandate, the requirement for everybody to have health insurance, these parts of the law, things like these preventive health services, services are unlikely to be struck down. It seems increasingly very unlikely that the entire law would be struck down in any case. And things like this are very far removed from that individual mandate.
Well, we're beginning to get some phone calls, so let's take one. The first one is Mary from Kansas City. Mary, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Yes, I'm glad to be here. Thank you. as a former welfare worker, I think this is a tremendous development, and also as a taxpayer, I am glad that something is being done to help reduce the number of unintended pregnancies, which it's very expensive for the United States healthcare system and for insurance companies to have to cover the cost of births, and then women who get divorced and don't have any job and they get on welfare, that can be greatly reduced. This is a great development for taxpayers. And also, if an insurance company has any brains, they should greatly help, be very, very happy to help any woman get birth control if she is not desiring to be pregnant.
Mary, thank you.
Fantastic.
Mary, thank you very much for the call. Let's take another one. This is Barbara joining us from Ogden, Utah. Barbara, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for taking my comment is that this availability of birth control could lead to a lot more unsafe sex. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you for the call. We'll take one more, then I'm coming back for a question for you, Julie Rovner. This is Lou in Cincinnati. Lou, you're on the air. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello. I'd like to strongly disagree with the last caller. It's 2011. That's my answer to that. Unsafe sex is happening. I've been with my boyfriend for 3 years. I've been at my job for almost 6 years. I've been having a fight with the health insurance company that wants us to buy birth control pills and any regular maintenance medication, they call it, in 3 month bulks of 3 months. Well, the problem is I've been buying it 1 month at a time my entire life. I'm 38 years old, and I can't always afford to buy it in a bulk of 3 months when I only need 1 month. And this is something they recently started. I was actually fighting back and forth, writing them letters, not getting my birth control because they refused to give it to me in a one-month interval at my local pharmacy when I got pregnant with my now 20-month-old daughter, who I love, and her father's been very supportive, but neither of us were, you know, really expecting this, obviously, or planning for it. So this is at the heart of what I've been fighting with my insurance company about. I've been buying it 1 month at a time my whole life, and all the years I've, you know, work where I work at. And so this is a sudden change. It's something they've gotten very rigid about. You can't just snap your fingers and expect someone to be able to buy this in three-month intervals, you know, just for a 2% discount, just because you think they suddenly have three times the amount of money that they normally have.
Lou, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate your comment. It raises the issue that I'd like to ask you about, Julie Rovner. One of the things that my research and reading up on this suggested that the decision to do this was based on statistics that showed, and correct me if I'm getting this right or wrong, that showed that 50% of the pregnancies were unwanted.
Unintended.
Unintended. There's a difference.
Yes.
I understand.
Yes, 50%, still to this day, 50% of pregnancies are unintended, and almost, I think, 40% of those unintended pregnancies end in abortion. So there's still an awful lot, you know, despite the widespread availability of birth control, there are still a lot of reasons that women don't use it. Polling has showed that a good portion of that is still financial, as this last caller has mentioned. I didn't bring it with me, but interestingly, the health insurance industry, was not thrilled with these recommendations. They're worried, and they have reason to be worried. If you put too many requirements, too many benefits into the benefit package, you're going to make the premiums too high at some point. They were worried about, you know, is there enough evidence base? And they weren't just talking about contraception. They were talking about for all of the recommendations made by the Institute of Medicine. But you can see where there is concern from the insurance industry that if the ultimate insurance package becomes too rich, that people won't be able to afford the premiums. And this goes back to what we were saying at the beginning. This is not free, per se. You're paying for it up front in your premium rather than paying for it month to month. So it's not you're getting it eventually, but you're also spreading the cost across everyone, and that's another thing to think about.
Some men in our audience are beginning to respond. I have two emails from them. I'll read the first one, and we'll take them one at a time, okay? First one is from Dave. He says, will condoms and vasectomies be available without copay or deductibles?
The way it's worded is all FDA-approved forms of contraception. FDA-approved prescription contraception. Condoms are not, you don't need a prescription for condoms. So they will not be. I don't think vasectomy, I do think some health insurers cover vasectomies now. But that's not part of this recommendation.
This is from another person, Morris, I believe is the name. It says, I think you said starting next year, women will not have co-payments to pay for birth control. We did say that. What about men using various erectile dysfunction medicines and ED medical devices?
The vast majority of those are already covered. That's one of the reasons that this is recommended, that's not really been an issue. That's obviously not a preventive health care issue. So that was not within the confines of what this was looking at. But in fact, that's been one of the arguments for many years among women's advocates that birth control is not covered, and yet men's erectile dysfunction drugs are. Viagra was covered, I believe, within a year of its being approved by the FDA, was covered by something like 80% of all health insurers.
So these recommendations were meant to level the playing field a little bit for women in terms of preventive care.
I don't think that was there. I don't think that was specifically what it was said, but that was certainly one of the underlying goals.
What about teenagers, teenage girls particularly, with respect to this? Those who are covered under their parents' health insurance, do they apply, or are there other rules with regard to having parental consent?
I believe there are other rules. Now, the Title X program, the Federal Family Planning Program, does have rules in which teenagers are required to be given services confidentially. So teenage girls who show up at federally funded family planning clinics can get contraception without telling their parents. That is a federal rule. This is different. This is simply what insurers have to provide in their insurance packages. So I don't think it speaks to that.
Okay, let's take another caller. This is Daryl calling us from Lake Worth, Florida. Daryl, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering if the government is mandating this new change to the insurance business, because even with the individual mandate, it's still a business. I'm wondering what the effect that taking away if it levels the playing field, it takes away one more way for companies to be competitive with each other and offer these as possible sales points.
Interesting question. Thank you very much, Daryl. What about that? I don't know the answer.
Oh, I think there's states have had insurance mandates for years. Some states have a lot of mandates. Some states have a few. But there's certainly nothing new about insurance mandates, about having certain services be covered by requirement. What's new, obviously, is having federal mandates. And that's something that's been a debate that's gone on since the late 1990s. This is part of what's called the Patient's Bill of Rights, which was included within the health law. But there had been a separate debate about having a Patient's Bill of Rights since the late 1990s, but as I mentioned, states have long had insurance coverage mandates, and they are for a wide variety of things, including some of them the insurance companies complain about include, I think, some states require hair transplants to be covered under health insurance.
We're talking about health care reform and some new provisions that will go into effect in a year that will allow women to get birth control without having to pay deductibles or copay. Our guest is Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for NPR, joining us here in Studio 3A. You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another caller. Let's go out to Syracuse. This is Oscar. Oscar, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The issue was brought up that the health insurance industry is concerned about premiums being raised because women can get birth control without any copays or any extra money. What about costs going down because women now may have more access to birth control and unwanted pregnancies will be reduced?
Thanks for the call. What are you saying?
I've always wondered about that, and everybody always raises the question. You know, it obviously costs a lot less to provide birth control than it does to pay for a pregnancy and then the ensuing child. But obviously, the health insurance industry has a lot of actuaries. They must have crunched the numbers and figured that it must cost more for the many, many, many women using the birth control than for the few who are going to have the unintended pregnancy.
Is there the danger that are those out there who will see this as easing the road to increased abortions, things of that sort, although abortion is not mentioned in this part of the law itself? Is there the danger of that sort of confusing the argument here?
There is, we should point out, this does not cover the abortion pill. The abortion pill, of which there is one, there is a medical, there's something called a medication abortion. This does not cover that. This does cover the morning after pill. That is an FDA-approved prescription contraceptive. There's two of them now. One just got approved last year. So there's one called Plan B and one called Ella. They are both approved as part of this. There are those who do believe that those can cause, a very early abortion by preventing the implantation of a fertilized egg. Most of the medical community disagrees with that. That's more of a belief system issue. But those morning after pills would be included as part of this mandate, and that is a problem. I should also mention, we glossed over it for a moment, that within this mandate is an exception for religious organizations that provide health insurance. They would be able to opt out of offering this contraceptive coverage if it violates their tenet. That has caused a bit of a backlash on the other side from women's groups who say, well, what about the people who work for those religious organizations whose tenets it does not violate and who want the birth control?
Are you making a distinction between, and maybe we'll have to get to this after the break, I'll ask you to think about this. Is there a distinction between a religious organization and, let's say, a religious hospital in terms of the applicability of this? We are talking about the Institute of Medicine's recommendations for preventive services recently adopted by the Department of Health and Human Services, especially the provision that provides insured women with birth control free of charge. What difference do you think this will make? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. We have a lot more coming up and some other points of view that we'll get to right after the break. I'm Tony Cox. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. On the phone now from her home in Maryland is Helen Alvarez. She is an associate professor of law at George Mason University and formerly worked in the Office of General Counsel at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. Helen Alvarez, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
There are concerns from religious organizations and hospitals about whether this violates their rights. Do you think the exemptions go far enough?
You know, the exemptions mimic a so-called religious employer's exception in California that was explicitly interpreted by the courts there to exclude really all Catholic hospitals, all Catholic social services. The exemption says that if we hire or serve non-Catholics and our primary purpose as a religious institution is not to inculcate the faith, then it's not covered. Well, I mean, gosh, religious hospitals, Catholic hospitals in particular, are the largest private providers of health care in the United States, the largest private providers to women, to the poor, to single women. And this really says to them, you have to decide to either stop providing insurance to your employees, stop hiring and stop serving people who are not of your faith. And, you know, the word Catholic in particular, it means universal. They really do believe in the equality of all humanity, and they've always thought that their hiring and serving people of all faiths was an asset. And now the federal government is saying this is a liability. If you do this, if you hire and serve non-Catholics, you can't abide by your conscience. They really could have drafted a broader conscience exception. We've had them around in the United States since the beginning of our nation. And this was a deliberate attempt. They knew what they were doing here. And it's a mystery to me why they want to throw out of the social service network these religious providers.
Let me bring Julian. This was to the very point that I was asking you about, the distinction between a religious organization and a religious hospital. Clearly, she doesn't think that the distinction that the government has drawn is a legitimate one. Are there others who share that view?
Yeah, I mean, there are others who share the view. And as I said, then there are others who say, who think just having any religious exemption at all puts at a disadvantage the people who are in those plans who want to be able to avail themselves of the no-cost contraception. So it's a difficult line to walk, obviously, for the government. They don't wish to require, obviously, people who don't believe in this to have to offer it, but they want to be sure that people who do want to have it are able to get it.
Helen, here's an email I'd like to read and get your response to it. It says, one of your callers was worried that readily available birth control would lead to more risky sexual behavior, but many studies have shown that this is not true. As a clinician who works on the front line dealing with the end result of the difficulty assessing birth control, namely providing abortion care, I can attest to the fact that this new policy will be welcome. What do you say to that?
You know what? I would just be so grateful if that person would send those studies to my attention at George Mason. I've spent 24 months looking over all the literature in this field and writing a lot about it, both the law and economics literature, the sociological literature, and the psychiatric literature. And really, I haven't seen anything that discounts the statistics that shows that since the federal government got into encouraging, and I think Julie used that word appropriately, when you have a preventive service, it's encouraging language. All the data I've ever seen shows that since the federal government, and state governments too, have gotten into encouraging and normalizing the notion that, you know, unprotected sex makes babies. And you've seen a rise in the number of uncommitted sexual encounters, a rise in out-of-wedlock pregnancies, a rise in out of wedlock births, a rise in abortions, a rise in STDs to the point where one out of every four girls has got one in their adolescence. It just seems to me we can all understand why people would think logically contraception will prevent a pregnancy. And at the level of an individual person ingesting it, it seems to make scientific sense. But at the level of a social policy, when a society ingests this idea, you really do get a change in the sex, mating, and marriage market. I've never seen any literature to contradict that. So I guess I would love if this clinician would send that to me, because I would try to incorporate that in future thinking.
Here's one final question for you. We appreciate the time you've given us today. Do you think that groups opposed to the measure have any legal options?
It's tricky. Very quickly, since the Smith decision in 1990 by the Supreme Court, a neutral law of general applicability, one that applies to everybody, does not usually allow religious employers to make a guaranteed free exercise claim. This religious exemption was tested in a California Catholic Charities case, and it didn't win over a free exercise claim. So they might try, and I think there are some creative arguments that have been developed since 1990, but the federal government knew it was putting the religious employers in a position of choosing between serving the public and maintaining their integrity.
Helen Alvarez is an associate professor of law at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. Helen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
As we've been asking you, our listeners, will this change whether or how you get birth control? What do you think the impact will be? Give us a call, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation.
I should point out that this is not the final word on this religious exemption. This is what's called an interim final rule, and actually the Obama administration specifically asked for public comment on that part of this. So they want the public to comment on this this question of whether religious employers should be able to opt out and to what extent. So they will be taking comment on this, and there's a potential that policy could be altered before it goes into effect next August.
Julie Robner, thank you very much. Joining us now from a studio at UCLA, where she is the Dean of the School of Public Health, is Dr. Linda Rosenstock. She chaired the committee that issued the recommendation. Dr. Rosenstock, thank you for coming with us.
Pleasure, Tony.
Perhaps you can, I don't know if you can speak to the issue that we have been talking about right now with regard to the religious exemption. Is that something that even was in the purview of putting together these recommendations?
Well, actually, our committee was given a very specific task, which is really just to look at the data the scientific evidence of if certain new interventions were added for women, would it improve their health and well-being? So we were actually did not look at costs per se. We did not look at personal beliefs per se. And we did have an opportunity to say, well, what's missing from this important transition in the healthcare reform legislation to put a focus on prevention? What else could women use that would work well for them? And having listened to the conversation earlier, one of the things that we were so enthusiastic about was, in general, prevention has a focus in healthcare reform, in addition to broadening access. And although a health insurer might be concerned that a premium might go up a little bit at the front end, there's no question that we have lots of evidence that preventive measures that work may, in fact, save many dollars. But sometimes you don't see that saving until a decade or two later, depending on what you're preventing.
I'm going to read a couple of emails. We'll take some calls, and I have another question for you. This email comes from, I don't see the name on it, but I'll just read it. I take the responsibility of preventing pregnancy upon myself. A government preventing pregnancy is like government preventing skateboarding. It is dependent upon the individual to take care of themselves. I don't want to pay for somebody who cannot control themselves from procreating. Oh, that's John in Philadelphia. This is Deborah. My husband worked for a Catholic hospital, and therefore our insurance will not cover any birth control. Will this mandate change this? We've already talked a little bit about that. We had a caller earlier, a doctor, who was talking about the economics of this and whether or not it would change the dynamic between businesses, which leads me to this question. Could the copay that the women will now not have to pay at all, would that money simply be transferred into the cost of the premium? So you're paying it, but it's just not being called a copay because now your premium has gone up to include that.
Well, actually, what will happen is that the cost will be spread more broadly. So I think the estimates from even the insurers themselves would be a rather modest increase, certainly nothing like the $20 to $50 per month that some women are now paying, for example, to take advantage of family planning. And our recommendation was that the broad array of FDA-approved medicines and devices be available. So I think the problem that you face is we know this not just for the services we've recommended, but for other preventive services. And it's why the Affordable Care Act changed that, was that preventive services, when there is a financial barrier to them, often means that they're not used. And again, the benefit long-term and sometimes short-term is to improve not just health, but also to reduce costs. So I believe that the barrier is a real one. We have lots of evidence of women not, and you heard a caller who said it, not taking advantage of services that might be available to them. And what we call first dollar coverage should increase the availability of these services to the woman working with her physician who chooses to utilize these. And of course, our recommendations went well beyond family planning. They did, as mentioned, include well women visits and other kinds of interventions that we think have proven benefits to increase women's health.
Let's take a couple of callers. This is Gail from Denver, Colorado. Gail, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thanks, Tony and Julie. I was curious, what tools will be used for tracking the effectiveness of this program?
Good question. Do we know the answer?
Well, certainly there's an enormous amount of data that the Department of Health and Human Services collects, both through, everyone is moving to electronic medical records. That's one of the reasons to move to electronic medical records, is to be able to collect that data. And certainly there are many surveys that are done every year. So there's a lot of data collection that's built into this law to find out, in fact, how well these things work.
Do you have anything you'd like to add to that, Doctor?
Absolutely. I think that the tracking of any of these interventions is going to be important. We know what we know. But for example, as I mentioned, if you avoid a problem now that, let's say, you find diabetes in a pregnant woman, which often means that she's at risk for diabetes beyond the pregnancy, and you treat it and you avoid cardiovascular disease 20 years later, which we have evidence you would, that's a benefit that's hard to judge right now. But as we track issues over time, I think we'll have a full and better sense of not just whether this is improving health, but the cost effectiveness of these interventions.
The topic, no deductible, no copay birth control under the new health care reform bill. We are talking with Julie Rovner, NPR health policy correspondent, and Dr. Linda Rosenstock, dean of the UCLA School of Public Health. You are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. right, here are a couple of more emails. This comes from Carla in Overland Park. Carla writes, I began taking birth control in order to suppress my reproductive system and reduce the pain of endometriosis. There are, I believe, medical conditions that are helped by birth control pills. How do the new rules respond to that issue? Doctor.
Well, our view would be that once these are on a recommended preventive service, that it would likely be covered as well. The first dollar coverage for these medications will largely go for avoiding unintended pregnancy. But as this listener has identified, there are medical reasons beyond unintended pregnancies that call for the use of these interventions. I also want to mention something else that hasn't been said. There's been a lot of talk about the unintended pregnancies, and we all know that they are the largest cause of abortions in this country, so that's an indirect benefit if we reduce unintended pregnancies. But another reason to undertake family planning is to get optimal spacing of children. Lots of evidence coming in that having children spaced closer together than 18 months has bad health effects for not just the mother, but as well for the newborn. So there are many reasons that family planning services can improve health, not just for the mother, but for the newborn.
Let's take another call. This is Melanie from Rocky, North Carolina. Melanie, welcome. Hi, Melanie. Are you there? Oh, we lost her. All right, let me read this email. This is from Heather. Heather says, for a brief moment, I was excited about my free birth control, and then I remembered that I am a recent college graduate, currently job searching, and still on my parents' health insurance through the Catholic diocese. If I had an option, I'd go elsewhere, but I'm stuck. This restriction applies not just to the people working for churches, but to their children and family members, and we're the ones burdened with not being able to opt out of their narrow and out-of-date understanding of sexual health. I'm 23 years old, need birth control for both sexual reasons and health-related reasons, and cannot afford it. And unfortunately, I won't see the benefits of this law. Julie Rovner, what's your reaction to hearing that?
Well, there are many polls out there that show that 98% of American Catholic women have used birth control that the Catholic hierarchy does not approve of. So it is definitely an issue. And as we said earlier, that's sort of what the government is grappling here with these opt-out provisions. They don't wish to require the religious organizations to violate their beliefs in providing it, but they also don't want they want that, women like the author of this email who would like to whose beliefs are not being violated in using it to be able to get it. So it is a difficult line to parse.
Absolutely. Doctor, let me thank you for coming and being on with us and sharing your information and expertise. Dr. Linda Rosenstock is the dean of the UCLA School of Public Health. She joined us from a studio on the UCLA campus. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Julie, in the few seconds that we have left, what's the prognosis for this? Is it going to go forward? Is it a 50-50 chance that it may happen, it may not, or will it more than likely happen?
Oh, I think it will more than likely. Certainly these services will more than likely happen.
All right, Julie Rovner, health policy correspondent for NPR, joined us here in Studio 3A. Julie, thank you very much as well.
You're welcome.
Tomorrow, it is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with a look at longevity and a group of centenarians who smoke, who drink, and who overeat just like average Americans. And Neil Conan will be back here on Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox in Washington.